You're listening to the Lament Configuration Podcast. It's a podcast about shit that makes us sad. I'm your host, Julia Griffair. I'm one of the leading horror graphic novelists, and with me is my co-host,
Gretchen Felker-Martin, horror author and film critic.
One of the leading horror novelists, as it turns out.
Wow. I'll take it. Thank you.
So, Gretchen's publisher, Tor Nightfire, released the book cover for her new novel, Manhunt, which comes out next February. It takes so long for a book to come out. It's the worst. But the book is very good.
It's awful. I really miss just sort of putting it out when I was done.
I know, right? The nice thing about zines is that you can like make it and then have it be a book the next day. Like I have done that for cons. I'm sure you've seen me do that for cons more times than I would like to admit, honestly.
I have helped you do that for cons.
Yeah. Like that Frasier zine that I did, I think like a week before a convention, I was like, oh shit, I don't have anything new for this. And I'd worked on it for a couple days, you know, the way that I do where I'm like, I have this thing in mind and it's just all I do until it's done. And I took it to the printer and I picked the copies up from the printer and I went straight from there to, I think it was Mocha. That's how it goes. But with a real publisher, you can't do that. Even Fantagraphics takes like a year.
Yeah, quite a process.
But we got to see the book cover, which is very cool and stylish. You should check it out, listeners. It was designed by Sarah Sutkin.
The sculptor who did a lot of the monsters in season 2 of Channel Zero, which is one of my favorite horror shows.
Yeah, they are horrifying. She's incredible. The book cover is very striking. The tagline is also very striking.
Thank you. Yeah, I got a very good response when I pitched that.
Tell them what it is, Gretchen.
So the tagline is, the end of the world is nuts. And this
tell
is because
them what the book's
some
about.
Of the book. Some of the book, Manhunt, revolves around eating testicles. Because in this future where all men have become raving cannibalistic monsters thanks to a virus, the most reliable and accessible source of estrogen is testicles. And this is actually, testicles do store estrogen and produce it. It's just that the bodies of people with testicles typically absorb it very differently or do not absorb it.
Go ahead, sorry.
Two plums, one with a bite taken out of them in a red mesh bag like you'd get at the grocery store.
It's very like
pointed.
The plums in the bag are really red and they're on a black background, so it has like a classic horror vibe, I think.
Yeah, it looks very paperbacks from hell.
Yeah.
But anyway, this time the viral tweet was not my fault.
Yes. Which viral tweet are we talking about? Is it the one where you hate bisexuals or the one where you hate non-binary people?
Oh my god. I guess it's the one that people decided meant that I hate transmasculine people and non-binary people.
Before we get into that, why don't you talk a little bit about what your book is about? I mean, you just did, but maybe in a little more detail. Because I'm sure that our listeners would love to know, and also because it provides a little context for the utter madness that was to follow.
All right. So my novel, Manhunt, which is my first like mainstream published novel, is about two trans women, Beth and Fran, who both live in this post-apocalyptic United States in New England and make their living by hunting men and trading the refined estrogen from their testicles and the lobes of their kidneys.
And the apocalypse has been going on for a little while at this point, right? Like a couple years?
Right. They're 5 years deep in it.
Right.
And it also follows their traveling companion and eventual friend, Robbie, who is a trans man who, because he was off his medication for top surgery, did not get sick when the plague struck. If your body does not naturally produce testosterone, you can still catch the plague, but you'll die instead of mutating into a monster, because eventually your body will stop producing testosterone when you stop injecting it, and then the virus dies. Anyway,
it's hard to find the supplies to be on any kind of medication 5 years deep in an apocalypse.
Right. There's a part in the book later where someone talks about how there's a couple of pill manufacturing centers that are active in Canada, and they're very sought after and like heavily militarized. Mm-hmm. And it's just for like blood pressure stuff and, you know, insulin.
So talk a little bit about what the victims of the plague are like, the people who contract it, what happens to them.
So the people who contract the plague suffer a really awful sort of mind scrambling fever. And then they go through a physical transformation where their skin splits open. They rapidly put on a lot of muscle mass by usually cannibalizing people around them, and they go irrevocably insane and become compelled to hunt and rape anything they can get their hands on. They're basically just monsters. They're predatory animals. Mm-hmm. And so for Beth and Fran, the constant fear is that if they run out of estrogen and they run out of things that they can use to naturally suppress testosterone, they will contract the plague.
It's basically inevitable.
Yeah.
So there's little pockets of trans women who are scraping away at subsistence. And meanwhile,
right, they're called manhunters.
And what are the cis women doing?
So cis women are doing a lot of different things in this society, but some of them centered on a sort of fledgling neo-fascist government in Maryland have formed a trans exclusionary fascist dogma and turned it into a government.
It's a trans exclusionary radical fortress.
Yeah. And at the start of the book, they're in the process of annexing Boston because they're very well organized and heavily armed. And I felt like this was pretty easy to make plausible because in reality, TERFs are heavily and strongly connected to a lot of right-wing institutions, which is where the guns are.
Right.
So yeah, the villains of this book are an older woman who is a former government interrogator from Guantanamo Bay. No one knows her real name, but she's referred to as Teach. And she has XX tattooed on her forehead for her chromosomal makeup. And
literally and figuratively.
Yeah. And she sort of surrounds herself with militant young women who she uses as military death squads to wipe out any pockets of trans women. And the rationale behind this is that they're an inevitable threat that will sooner or later transform into monsters and start ripping society apart from the inside again.
Mm-hmm. So what are trans men doing during this time, other than robbing?
Well, trans men who are alive in the book are doing a number of things. You know, Robbie lives alone in the woods and basically just exterminates as many men as he can find. He's very withdrawn from society. There are some other transmasculine people who we meet later on in the book, one of whom is a librarian at a small commune in northern Massachusetts. And there's at least one other transmasculine person at that commune who I think is a cook. It's been a minute since I've reread my own work. But it's primarily about trans women.
Mm-hmm. So, shall we talk about your viral tweet?
Yeah, let's talk about it.
It did occupy like a lot of my thought this week, because I'm excited for you and because there was a lot of really positive response to it. And then there's just like a handful of people who have to be pricks about it. And those people just really preoccupy me.
Yeah, the huge majority of people were very excited about the book and have been just super supportive and kind and enthusiastic. And I really could not be more grateful. But good God, are those just joyless little dickheads so loud.
Yeah. So I'm struggling for the right words to explain this without just being like, look, these fucking idiots. They heard that it was a book about trans women finding a way to get their HRT during the apocalypse so that they would not be susceptible to the plague. And I think that maybe having a story that is primarily concerned with the experiences of trans women is just fundamentally rankles some people. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if we talked about this, but a couple of weeks, maybe a month ago, there was that trans guy who got really mad that there weren't more trans men.
Yes.
In Tori Peters' debut novel, Detransition Baby,
mm-hmm.
which is primarily about women, trans and cis. And I want to be compassionate because I think this is a small minority of trans men who are kind of unself-aware and probably hurting in some way. But it's just really unpleasant behavior to demand that actually anything a trans woman does should be about me, which is a lot of what I heard this week.
Yeah. The issue with the book was very much like, with your book, I mean, was that they assumed that there would be no trans masculine people of any kind in the book because they weren't mentioned in the like 100 tweet. Character long tweet. And when they saw that the plot involved a plague where people with testosterone in their systems became monsters, then it brought up this whole other conversation about the fear of testosterone in general, which
right.
is what the book's about. But
yes,
they were not seeing it in that way. What they were seeing was more like, oh, this is a trans woman and she hates testosterone because she, you know, is trying to get rid of it or whatever. And everybody who has it, she thinks it's a monster.
Their intention really didn't include that idea. It was more just like she hates trans men because that's the group that's associated with testosterone. And first of all, that's not a remark even worth addressing. Second, this book is really about my relationship to testosterone and to my fears of it being seen as a man or mannish or monstrous. And I sublimated those fears and anxieties into this plague, which makes them real.
Mm-hmm.
That's a way for me to talk about this thing that shapes every day of my life.
Right.
And if that doesn't square with someone else's relationship to testosterone, I don't understand why that means anything about my book.
Well, the implication,
you know, then it's not for you.
Right. It seemed to be that there was an ongoing conversation in certain circles about testosterone being a kind of poison. Like I kept seeing that brought up that there's that, oh, this is part of the testosterone is poison discourse.
Yeah, I had that thrown at me a lot. I was unaware of that beforehand.
Yeah, I mean, I was also not really aware that it was a... I mean, but when I was reading about, when I saw that people were talking about that, I was like, okay, like this is... Like, I understand that that's a conversation that people have. Like, I think that we've all seen, like, you know, somebody do some really stereotypically masculine thing and been like, ugh, testosterone, am I right? You know? Like... That's a thing. Sure. That's a meme or whatever.
Yeah. And I know a lot of trans masculine people who have agonized about going on T in particular, but generally about whether or not it's immoral to become a man or mannish. And I really sympathize with that. It's got to be a frightening thing. But what I've always said when helping those people try to come to some kind of peace, because they're my friends and I love them, is that being a man is whatever you make of it as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
There, you do not have to follow society's scripts. There's nothing inherently evil or rancid about men.
Mm-hmm. And if you're an adult male, then you get to call yourself a man and make that mean whatever you want.
Yep, absolutely. And it, you know, it may mean that some people are a little slower to trust you, but... Again, this is sort of about the ways in which people's reactions to each other do and don't matter outside of their own lives.
Mm-hmm. Here's the thing. A lot of apocalypse scenarios, because as has been pointed out many times this week, it's a genre.
Yep.
Don't address very much like what happens to people who are receiving medical treatment, people who are disabled, right. people who... need certain types of interventions in order to have any kind of quality of life. And I think in a lot of stories, those people are just assumed to have died while the able-bodied people are, you know, building their new Eden or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that it's kind of a implicit genetic cleansing, right? Because the idea is that all the weak people die off.
A lot of apocalyptic scenarios are very, very scenarios. Apocalyptic scenarios are very, very fascist in a lot of different ways, and are really sort of silently built upon the idea that anyone undesirable is now dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I use undesirable here in the sense that the Nazis used it.
Right. I spent some time looking through some older Twitter conversations, and one of the things that comes up occasionally is the essay that you wrote where you said that being gay is deviant or something like that.
Yes. That,
is that what it was? And people were like, oh, she thinks gay people are deviants. And it's like,
You need people really fight against.
We're talking about, like, we're within a culture that like, there's a norm that there are punishments if you don't adhere to it. Like,
right. It's context.
Yeah.
Being gay is not something that happens in a vacuum and you put it in your Twitter bio. Being gay happens in the world.
And happens in a world where
throughout my life
is a minority thing to be. You know, like, I have red hair. Being a red-haired person is also deviant. It's not.
Yes.
It's simply because morally
it
neutral.
Deviates from the center of the bell curve.
Because it's weird.
Most people don't.
Most people don't.
I was just going to say the fourth perspective character in Manhunt is Indiresh, who's a doctor. She's a fertility specialist. And she is disabled. She's very fat and can't travel very far. And what I really wanted to do with that character is, first of all, just write about someone with a body like mine, which is so absent from basically all art. And secondly, attack the idea of, like, usefulness and physical prowess and violence as the sole tools for navigating the end of the world.
Right. Because most of these scenarios don't really play out like Gilligan's Island, where it's the professor keeping everybody alive.
Right.
It's the assumption is usually that it's going to be the very strong, the very able, the very healthy, the very young. Those are the people who
Beautiful white people.
Yeah. It's basically the Blue Lagoon.
Yeah.
I've been reading about the Blue Lagoon. I've never read the Blue Lagoon, but I kind of want to now. Do you know it was written in, I think it's from 1907?
I didn't know that.
Yeah. It's a series of novels. I mean, because it was written in 1907, I think there are some questionable elements to it. But it's also it's very interesting to me. Well, this is not what we're talking about. We can talk about the Blue Lagoon another time after I've read it. The point is, like, the main characters in it are young, wealthy white children who, you know, grow up to be, like, strong, proud, self-sufficient, beautiful young adults who live this very idyllic existence until, you know.
Right, it's like the
encountering tragedy through no fault of their own.
It's like the often overlooked central message of The Lord of the Flies, which is not, this is what people are like in a vacuum, but this is what upper class British boys are like in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're going to have a specific set of people that your story is about, you should be conscious of that. You should tell a story that could only occur with those people.
And I think you don't really lean on this very much in the book, but it definitely does play out in the book that the people who are able to look out for each other are the poor and the weird.
Yeah. I mean, a large part of the book is
that's just reality.
Set in the I mean, rich people are not generous at all.
No.
They're cruel and stingy, and if they do give you any kind of aid, it usually comes with some kind of awful strings or moral judgment or rules.
Poor people give
a way bigger percentage
of their income to charity than the rich do.
Yes. A big part of the book, the whole central section, occurs in the private bunker of a tech heiress who is sort of the de facto queen of this little kingdom of like 700 or 800 people. And I, you know, I didn't want to have like a whole Hobbesian monologue about the brutality of life in there, but I did want to talk about the sort of person that wealth breeds.
Right.
And I don't think that rich people are good as a rule of thumb. I think they're really putrid and reptilian, and that's cruel to reptiles, who I really love. A crocodile is a much better person than Bill Gates.
Rich people don't have feelings. Crocodiles have feelings. No, they don't.
You know, yes. Crocodiles have many vocalizations that they use to communicate with one another.
Rich people don't have vocalizations.
No, rich people don't make any sounds. Yeah, I pretty much agree with that Gibson line. The very rich are no longer even remotely human.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some I would say that theme takes a backseat to things that I wanted to say about white cis womanhood.
Right.
Conventional attractiveness or marketable attractiveness, which is a way that I really like to describe that.
Yeah.
Because so much of it is sort of inextricably bound up in capitalism. Because I think that there is a sort of turfy school of thought that women are inherently better people than men.
Mm-hmm.
And that there is some sort of naturally caring and nurturing impulse in women.
Ugh.
Which I think is extremely stupid and doesn't survive contact with like hanging out with 10 different women.
Right.
So, but it's this myth that a lot of gender essentialist people cling to really hard.
Mm-hmm.
That there is sort of a utopia implicit in the idea of an all women or matriarchal society. And I mean, certainly history is replete with examples of individually horrible women, but also any time that a woman has had the same kind of power that a man does, she acts the same.
Right.
You know, Margaret Thatcher, Hillary Clinton, all of these powerful figures who immediately did everything their predecessors did.
Mm-hmm.
A woman ascending to power has no inherent meaning in any kind of evaluation of feminism or gender equality or really any kind of progressive framework that you care to apply.
Right.
It's just a, you know, is the finger on the drone strike button manicured or not?
Wow, Gretchen, not every woman has to have a manicure, God.
Yeah, I know. I'm very sexist.
Did we have more that we wanted to talk about the internet, or do you want to just do questions now?
I would love to do some questions.
All right. I mean, we could talk about your book more, too, but I don't want to give everything away. I feel like they know enough.
I feel like, yeah. I think we've dropped enough hints. Let's go to questions.
All right.
I will go up to the first unanswered one. Oh, this is a fun one. This comes from Jardanus. If you got the opportunity, what would your dream league of extraordinary gentlemen be? Continuity, sense, and time periods be damned. And why are they assembled there?
Okay. What is the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen? I mean, I know it's like crossover fanfic, but with public domain characters. But like, what is their job?
Right.
What do they do?
Okay, so League of Extraordinary Gentlemen are kind of like the Ghostbusters.
Like they
get called in.
Ghosts? When
well, like supernatural menaces. Like they get called in when the aliens from the War of the Worlds invade London.
Oh, so their enemies are also public domain. This is like a Michael Kupperman comic.
Yeah, it is a lot like that.
Like Michael Kupperman does all these comics that are like, you know, revenge of the public domain heroes. And it's like Hercules, Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah. So it's
basically that.
It's the titular Invisible Man, Dr. Jekyll / Mr. Hyde, Alan Quatermain, who's a British pulp novel character who's sort of like a great white hunter figure.
Huh.
And then Mina Murray from Dracula.
I mean, I like Mina. We all like Mina, but like, why?
We all like Mina.
She's like going to type something.
In this setting,
she's a vampire hunter.
She's actually, they never specifically reveal if she has any powers or not, but she is incredibly long lived.
I thought you were going to say long legged. I was going to be like, yeah, that sounds about right.
And she's very magnetic and intelligent. So she's like the director of operations for their gang.
I don't know if they're actually.
I quite like the comics. I think they're very smart. And the second one in particular is like, yeah.
He only ever wrote one good book. No, I'm lying. I like Alan Moore. I think Alan Moore is a good writer. I don't like most of his books. I want to make that distinction.
I agree with you. From Hell is magnificent. One of the best graphic novels ever written.
It's the only one I like.
Most of his other stuff is not really for me.
It's not for me. But my League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Okay. It's going to be, Captain Nemo. And
oh, he's also in Alan Moore's League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. I forgot him.
Oh, man.
I know.
Okay, I can't have Captain Nemo. That's too bad. He's so cool.
Yeah, he rules.
He's basically the coolest.
That's a really good book.
I know, right? Yeah, Captain Nemo has like all the things that I like in a character. He's like, has a tragic backstory. He likes to eat seafood. He's mad at the world. He speaks a lot of different languages. That's cool. But he can't be in the thing, so doesn't matter. Lancelot, best knight in the world. Very useful to have around. Pippi Longstocking.
Solid.
The strongest girl in the world. And Montresor from The Cask of Amontillado.
Ooh, good choice.
And, and Kim from Kim.
Oh, cool. I like Kim.
He's terrific. The little friend of all the world.
Just a little guy.
Just a little guy that you can't get mad
at. If I were to assemble a League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, I would start with George Smiley from the John le Carré novels because he is intelligent and unassuming.
I was trying to pick people in the public domain.
Oh, yeah. The question said continuity and everything be damned. So we can pick whoever we want.
Oh, well, I don't know. Okay, George Smiley.
All right, so I'd start with George Smiley because he's unassuming and very intelligent. Mm-hmm. And then, man, this is harder than it seems at first.
I know.
Ooh, Ligeia from the story of the same name by Edgar Allan Poe, who is a woman who continually gives birth to herself. That's a very cool power.
Yeah.
Carmilla from, again, the novel of the same name, because you cannot go wrong with a hyper-emotional, hysterical lesbian vampire.
Mm-hmm. You would know.
I love Carmilla. Yeah. I love Carmilla because she's such a fucking wreck. Like, you know, Dracula's talking about conquering London and Carmilla's like, oh my God, I looked at you cross-eyed and now you probably want me to die and I'll never know love. And I'm going to hurl myself across the bed and kick my little feet and weep. Just a very relatable person.
Yeah.
And then who'd be a good fourth to round this out? They need like an everyman. And then James Bond.
Sure. What is going to happen if George Smiley hangs out with James Bond?
I mean, that's either like, Smiley's going to just
they're natural
crack him
opposites.
Psychosexually.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they are.
James Bond is going to have sex with Smiley's wife.
That will happen.
It's not hard to do.
Right. And then Smiley will be like.
And then Smiley will be constitutionally incapable of doing anything bad to him.
Right. And he will act as though nothing has happened.
Yeah. He'll have to specifically be extremely normal about it. Yes. So that you don't think that his feelings were hurt.
Because they weren't.
No. What feelings?
And I think that per the second half of the question, my League of Extraordinary Gentlemen would be assembled to hunt down and kill whatever produces the minions from Despicable Me.
Oh, that's too bad.
They have to come from somewhere.
Well,
I just think it would be interesting to see more about their breeding process.
You should watch the Minions movie. It covers all of that.
Good God.
I mean, you shouldn't watch it because it's really stupid. But I will tell you this, though. Having seen all three Despicable Me movies and the Minion movie, and I don't know if there's more after those. This, like, my knowledge about Minions cuts off sharply around the time that my son turned about 7. But out of those four, I like the Minion movie the best, for whatever that's worth. I think what I like about the Minions is that they speak the same language as the... Who's the guy in The Name of the Rose, the Cellarer's assistant, who like doesn't really speak any particular language.
The guy they're always comparing to a dog.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he speaks like this Argot.
Yeah, he speaks like a weird combination of Latin and French and Spanish and Italian. In the 14th century, Italian and Latin are like the same thing. But you know what I mean.
Funny. Yeah.
It's just like a big mashup where like if you understand like 1 1/4 of those languages, you can usually figure out more or less what he's saying. But the Minyan language is the same thing. Like they speak a gibberish, but it's a gibberish that's based on like languages that you would understand. I don't know. So that for me is fun to listen to. It's stupid, but and they
the sounds they make are funny.
They are funny. The part where like sometimes the minions can turn into like hairy purple minions, that's really disturbing to me. They like inject them with a weird drug. It's basically Manhunt. They turn into evil minions.
That's wild.
Yeah. And they turn purple and hairy and mean. Like I understand why people are bothered by the minions, but to me personally, I would say Boss Baby is about 1,000 times more insidious than the minions. Boss Baby should be destroyed. That's where the Leagues of Extraordinary Gentlemen are gonna they're gonna invade. Okay, so the premise of Boss Baby is that there's like a do you know what it is?
I do.
There's a business in heaven, you know, up on top of the clouds, that is producing babies commensurate with demand. And sometimes if the babies have more of a Glengarry Glen Ross personality than like an infant personality, then they go into management. But I forget why the Boss Baby has to go to Earth. I think he's like on a mission to find out some, there's like their competitor is like trying to breed the perfect pet. And if people get these perfect dogs, then they're not going to want to have babies anymore. So he, you know, it's like, anyway, the concept of heaven where babies come from being like the idea that they come from storks is obnoxious enough, but at least a stork is kind of attractive. Like the idea that babies come from middle management. Like I know that's the joke, but it's obscene. It's not funny.
It's disgusting.
It's disgusting.
There's nothing more repellent than a manager.
Yeah. Here's the thing about Glengarry Glen Ross. That guy is the villain.
Yeah.
He's a fucking prick.
Closers.
He ruins the lives of everybody in the story.
Yep.
Just the idea. Like, he's not even really in the movie. He's there for like 5 minutes. But what he represents is soul destroying.
Right.
He's and the they grinding... were like, what if this was a hilarious character in a children's movie, though? That's right, offensive.
The grinding, unceasing, illogical, cruelly stupid, willfully stupid spirit of capitalism.
Mm-hmm. Like, selling at all costs, no matter what anybody actually wants or has money for.
Right.
Anyway, Boss Baby's fucked up. I'd say send the League to destroy the Boss Babies. Blow up all the clouds. Send the... Okay, all right. My League of Extraordinary Gentlemen has Wilhelm Reich busting up the clouds that the Boss Babies live on.
That's very good.
Thank you.
He's flying around in his orgone chamber.
He's shooting them with his cloud buster.
Oh, of course. Of course. I'm sorry.
Thank you. And you can have that premise for free. Anybody who wants to write that, you're welcome to it.
The alien from Alien would be a really good villain for a League of Extraordinary Gentlemen story.
Is it possible to, like, how intelligent are the aliens? Can you communicate with them? Could you be like, hey, buddy, can you kill the Boss Baby? Or they just kind of do what they want?
I think you can communicate with the aliens. Actually, I know you can, because when Ripley threatens to use a flamethrower on the alien queen's eggs and aliens, she understands the threat and commands her drones to back down.
Huh. That is pretty intelligent.
Yeah. So definitely, like, at least as intelligent as dolphins or elephants.
Hmm.
So, you know, you can have some kind of connection with them, even if you don't fully understand its nature.
If it's obliged to be on your team, then...
I believe that the alien from Aliens could absolutely decimate the business establishment of Boss Baby.
Yeah. Plus, it would be easier for them to get there because they can travel through space already.
That's very true. You want to move on to the next question?
Sure. Whatever.
Okay. This comes from Squillette. What is your favorite episode in The Young Pope / The New Pope? I'll ask you about The Sopranos once I'm done watching it.
I don't know. I don't remember episodes. Gretchen, you say yours.
Yeah, I'll start. And if you think of some,
I'm not going to.
Okay.
I'm good.
My favorite two episodes of The Young Pope are the fifth episode, in which Lenny addresses the College of Cardinals. And he does this in the full medieval papal regalia with a jeweled tiara carried in by litter bearers and flanked by people with, you know, ostrich feather staves. And the music from The Shining plays as he talks about how the Catholic Church is going to retreat into mystery and obscurity and frustration and force its followers to crawl after it through a narrow, uncomfortable, and frighteningly small theological passage. That's like one of the all-time great scenes in television, as far as I'm concerned. And then my other favorite episode is the ninth episode, in which Father Gutierrez, who is just like the sweetest, saddest man in all of fiction, like you just want to pull his head against your breast and stroke his bald little dome.
Yeah.
He is pitted against the Archbishop of New York, who is a serial pedophile and child predator. And it's just, it's so sad and human and delicate. It also has one of the very few sympathetic television portrayals of like a very fat bedbound person who is just afforded a really remarkable amount of dignity, considering what is typical in television, which is that those people are either jokes or just like a disgusting thing to be sad about.
You know, Voiello would be great to have in your League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Oh my God, what an amazing character he would be in that. Just like, you have no idea how vast his powers are, both within the Vatican walls and abroad.
That was a very good Voiello.
Thank you.
Imagine if you had a team that had Voiello and George Smiley.
That would be just an incredible duo. I feel like they would probably get along really well.
What all you would need is like a charismatic leader to have them whisper in his ears. And they would take over the world.
Yeah, they would just need like a Jamie Lannister or something.
Oh, hell yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Is it Jamie Lannister with or without spine?
I mean, like, I feel like when Jamie has spine, the result is usually okay. I mean, he's not like someone who's going to turn rogue.
Yeah. I mean, the problem is that he's not too bright. But if he had George and Voiello to tell him what to do, maybe.
Yeah, I think we just solved Game of Thrones.
Here's the thing about the Mad King. George Smiley wasn't there. I don't know if George could have handled that.
Yeah,
George couldn't really handle control. He couldn't control the Mad King.
I think he probably would have just been burned alive.
Yeah, he would have been one of the first ones to get burned alive.
Yeah.
He'd be like, oh, I beg your pardon. Am I not burning fast enough?
And I would say that my favorite episode of The New Pope is probably the one with all the graphic sex between the Vatican press secretary, Sophia, and her really awful husband. It's just like very hot. It has a lot of glory hole, both in actuality and metaphorical. And it conflates like that anonymous act of fellation with the Catholic sacrament of confession, which I think is very smart.
Oh, so good.
And it's just so hot and so good and so beautiful. God, that show is so beautiful to look at.
Yes.
I love both of those shows. I think they're really some of the best television ever made.
Yeah, they're pretty spectacular.
Yeah. All right. On to the next question.
Okay.
This comes from Inanimate Carbon Ron.
Ron.
How many bad ideas do you throw away for every good idea you ultimately use?
I don't know. You don't know whether it's a good idea or a bad idea until you use it.
Right.
But here's the thing. Ideas are not valuable. There's no, like, having a great idea is not going to make or break your career. You got to have, like, a lot. You got to have enough that you can have a really great idea and fuck it up in the execution and still have a bunch more that you don't fuck up.
Yeah. You really have to be constantly shitting and puking ideas.
Yeah. It's like, I'm not very good at growing plants, so forgive me if this is a bad metaphor, but like when I've tried to plant seeds, like you do the little starts and like you, some of them live and some of them don't, but you can't say like, how many good seeds are there before you get a carrot? Like there's all these different stages where like you can fuck it up or you know, like a bad carrot could turn out to be a really good one, or you know, sometimes you have a really great seed and it just doesn't come out right. Like ideas Absolutely. Are nothing. Ideas are a very small part of the process.
An idea really is just the first brick and you still have a whole house to build.
The idea is not even the blueprint. The idea is less than the blueprint.
That is correct.
So I guess like a lot.
Yeah, like a ton. But you know, as we're saying here, volume is the key. As my friend Lydia puts it, shots on net is what counts.
What does that mean?
Which is it's a basketball term for people who have a low rate of success, but shoot so often that they score more than people who have a much higher rate of success because they're unafraid to take a chance.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Yeah.
That's your friend Lydia nailed it.
Yes, they did. They're very smart. All right. Here's a good one. This comes from F. Den Ring. What would you say to someone who feels a painful need to create but runs up against a wall of shame and frustration every time they try? That's definitely something I can understand. And I have felt some of those things in my life, though I'm lucky enough to have been encouraged with art for the most part. I would say to that person that if you let yourself do it, eventually everything that you are coiled tight around and trying to prevent people from seeing and trying to prevent yourself from integrating with will come out, and you will start to feel like a more complete and contiguous person, and it's going to be better in the long run. You're going to be happier. You're going to be more able to express yourself. Just let yourself do it. There's nothing to lose.
That's a much more charitable response than mine, which is that if you have like a wall of inhibition that is prohibiting you from creating things, then you don't want to create things badly enough. And either you're going to have some ideas that make that wall come down, or I guess you're going to have to find ways to whittle away that wall if you really want to overcome it.
And the only way to whittle it away is just let yourself do something.
Making some lower stakes work is one way to make that happen. Because you will eventually make something public that is kind of embarrassing for you, and you'll find that the reaction is not as apocalyptic as you thought that it might be. And
I've written many things that are embarrassingly, sometimes painfully personal.
Oh, all my work is like very embarrassing. But other people don't read it that way. They don't know which parts you're ashamed of and which parts you think are cool.
As I once said, I avoid anyone having any knowledge of like my sexual fantasy life by just putting everything I can possibly think of on the page. Mm-hmm. So they don't know what's getting me hot and what isn't.
Right.
But even beyond that, no matter how honest and sort of unflattering I've been in my work, people do not react like I had been afraid they would react. They just don't. No one is going to be meaner to you than you.
Yeah, people don't really know about your shame when they're like consuming your, especially with fiction.
Feelings do not cross between bodies.
Yeah, like here's the really cool thing is nobody, not even people who love you very much, can look inside your head and know the things that scare you and the things that excite you. Unless you tell them. And people will not have magical insight to you because of the work that you make. Think about how hard it is to get people to understand you when you're directly trying to tell them. It's really hard. People are not going to just suddenly understand your darkest secrets because you put them in a book. They're going to be like, oh, that's a metaphor for, you know, the Spanish Inquisition or some shit. Like, people bring their own shit to your book and they're like, oh, I know what she's trying to say. She's trying to say some shit that you are not trying to say. They're not going to read your mind. If they think that it's weird, they're going to think you did it on purpose because you like to be weird. If you think it's hot, you will probably write it in a way that convinces other people that it's hot. And then they'll be like, oh shit, what's happening to me now? I'm a freak. And then you'll just spread the freakishness far and wide.
A friend once convinced me that there is something inherently erotic about mascot costumes, which I have no interest in any of that. But
what was it? It was something about how if you put it on, you can smell the other person's body that was in it before.
Wasn't yes, it? Like mascot costumes are typically shared by multiple very small people over the course of like an event, and you're trapped inside with the other person's like accumulated smells.
Yeah. And we were like, oh my God.
And also you're basically blind and led around. You know, it's a very hot conceit.
I mean,
and I've also found that anyone who's going to give you shit would do it regardless. And it doesn't matter what you write.
People are trash. People who want to be fussy little prisses are going to find a way to make fun of it. I mean, like, do you remember being a kid and like getting picked on by somebody for doing some totally normal shit? Like,
yep.
One time I remember being in like the seventh grade and somebody threw a volleyball at my face or something. And then she ran over to get it and she picked it up off the floor and went, "Get a clue, Julia." And I was like, "You just hit me in the face with a volleyball." Like, I can't. People are going to make fun of you for shit. I mean, I probably didn't have a, I still don't have a clue about volleyball. But the point is, people are going to think you're an idiot if they think you're an idiot. Like,
yep.
They're going to make fun of whatever you do, whether you try to hit the volleyball or not. So you might as well just fucking hit it.
And I think we should end on that note.
Sure.
Just go do it. Just go try it and try it and try it.
Go hit it.
And if it's something you really want, you'll get into it.
Mm-hmm.
So you've been listening to Lament Configuration, a podcast about the shit that makes us sad. You can follow us on anchor.com and wherever podcasts are.
Anchor.fm.
Well, excuse me, princess.
God forbid. Somebody should go to anchor.com.
And wherever podcasts are hosted.
Yeah. Leave us, rate us, review us, leave us 5 stars. Join our Discord. Tell us that you love us. If you don't suck our dicks, we will kick you off.
Yes.
That's the rule of the Discord.
Yeah. You have to suck our dicks.
Yeah. I mean, that's the cool thing about Discord is that if people are not chill to you, you can just flick them away like little bugs.
It's lovely.
I really like it. I love you, my brother.
And I, you, my brother, from bean to bar, as per usual.
As per usual.